By the way, I can't read Hegel, just for listeners here. I just can't do it.
Yeah, but you've seen people who have exhibited this kind of behavior, and then when you ask them, why are you like that, they're like, go read Hegel.
They've got, well, yeah, they've got a whole framework through Hegel and stuff like that, but it tends to be very, when people approach that, and it's not, I'm using Hegel as an example because it's kind of like a classic one, but there you can see it with, I think, pretty much any system that or philosophy that people want to get into. It can come across as very, there's something missing for sure in their life, basically, is the bottom line. And it comes across as very disconnected from, like, the world, basically.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought, because I'm sure there are a lot of very otherwise, like, I would not put it past a healthy person to say that something is missing in their life. Like, a lot of sane, happy people maybe have some desires for things. I think what feels really insidious about what you're talking about is that something is missing, and these people feel like they've filled the void. I have the system. I have some framework for framing everything that presents itself. I have something in advance that assures me that whatever may come, I have some kind of answer, right?
Yeah, and I think, yeah, that was actually something I was going to say, and I think it's really important to point out, is that, like, I'm not saying that, like, you know, you become kind of well-adjusted and a more of, like, a moderate philosophical individual, and that's somehow you achieve some sort of, like, wisdom zone where you're like, I've got it all. But I think there's a certain degree of, like, flexibility and groundedness that comes from having a kind of balance in our philosophical interests and passions and stuff like that. And exactly what you're saying, when people get really into and invested in a system, what it becomes is less, I'm interested in finding the answers, and more like, I have the answer. Like, I've always got it. It's locked, it's loaded, it's ready. And there's something very, and when I say there's something missing there, it's not like necessarily they're even aware of that. It's because I've interacted with people like this. They definitely will argue that they're not. I'd be assured of that. Hegel is not going to, or any philosopher, like, this is getting in more in my opinion of philosophy and anything like that. Following any philosopher, like it's some sort of laundry list or cooking list for life, is not going to be super helpful for you in the long run and living in the real world. I don't think that whether it's Plato or Hegel or Heidegger or Descartes or whoever it's going to be that you're really into, if you treat them kind of like someone who's got it all figured out and you just have to like follow along. First of all, I think for all those people, you're missing the point of what they're doing in the first place. But I also think that you're going to just delude yourself. Basically, it's too disconnected from everyday life. There has to be some sort of blending, if that makes sense to you.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I think one of the ways that does make sense to me is in this kind of observation you made that questions have replaced the answer, answers have replaced the questions. We came to a philosophical text with questions, and we treated those questions like holes that need to be filled, whereas questions don't have to be obstacles in the, you know, on the path to understanding. We have to get over the questions to get to the answers. One of the things that I realized when I was asking this question, this new kind of question that Sadler presented to myself, was that I feel like initially, my relationship to philosophical texts and the questions they presented to me was like that questions were more or less unresolved things. You know, I just hadn't read close enough. I just hadn't read the right secondary literature, or I just hadn't taken the right class. Later on, though, as I became a more, I guess, mature reader of philosophy, I learned that questions are not necessarily, like, you want to have some kind of, I don't want to say answer, but you want to not get knocked over by a question, for sure. But at the same time, there is a significance about questions, and questions are, I think, evidence that a text is significant. When the text continuously presents questions to you, questions that are kind of fueled by real life circumstances or people you meet, it shows a renewability in a philosophical text to be flexible and to try and remain faithful to reality without just having this one answer. When those questions stop showing themselves because you've hit all the nails on the head and it's just a nailed up board now, there's nothing more to figure out, it loses contact with reality in a certain way. I mean, questions are kind of the way that you insert reality into a text.
Yeah, I think we're hitting at something that's definitely what I would call the approach of philosophy, your motivation, which is kind of what we've been talking about the whole time. But what I mean by that is more philosophy as a tool. There's philosophy as a genuine search for wisdom on some level. But then I also think, kind of like we were talking about earlier, there's also a mode in which we can get into like philosophy as a weapon, right? Like an intellectual weapon. And I think, unfortunately, that happens a lot. People want to be smart, but that really clouds, like, I think on a really genuine level, that really clouds, you know, what, you know, the point is. And kind of like you were saying, what Sadler's getting at, like the important thing for most people, especially people starting to get into it, or really anyone, honestly, like me, you still now, is sort of just having almost like a natural disposition and sort of like being genuinely curious about like your life, reality, decisions, ethics, whatever it might be, and being like having this sort of kind of intellectual openness that I know when I've approached philosophical texts that have really impacted me, people like Kant, like Heidegger, like Aristotle, like Plato, people I would say who I've had a significant impact on my philosophical interest, I have really come at those with a position of like, I'm not like, I am genuinely like, life is kind of weird. This is a weird situation. It seems kind of fragile. What's going on? Right. Like, I know that sounds kind of like that's like a dude explanation, but I do genuinely mean like I think the most powerful times I've had is on really getting into specific philosophers and specific texts has come from a place of just wanting to have a little bit of more wisdom, which is very different from being smart, right? Like an enormous difference between being like, you know, intellectually quick and witty and, you know, a good arguer and whatever it's going to be, but really having a better sense of like, what is this thing that's going on right now, right? Like, and do these, like, what do these people have almost always, whom are long dead, what did they think, right? What was their kind of position? What was their exploration? Where did it take them? And can I join along for a little bit? Can I take anything from it? There's a certain degree of like humility, intellectual humility, that I think is really important for people to be able to really appreciate philosophy.
It's interesting that in this motivation towards wisdom, well, maybe it's not difficult to weaponize it because you can kind of turn it into a brand. You know, I transformed myself and you people haven't. Yeah, I started a YouTube channel or something like that. There is something that is much more difficult to weaponize about your own kind of changes in understanding and wisdom than, you know, being able to dissect an argument and say, here's why you're wrong, or be like rhetorically persuasive in, you know, practiced arguments or something like that. And it does answer that question of, okay, like, what is your goal going into philosophy? Because you can definitely go and read, like, I feel like that's for, you know, whether it's informed or misinformed, I think that's a big reason a lot of people who start will read things like, you know, Machiavelli or Sun Tzu or something like that. They just want, they, you know, they want to put a knife on their belt. Yeah, exactly. They feel like they need to arm themselves because they're going to trek into hostile territory, and they need to ward off people who are going to try and beat them up intellectually. And I think, unfortunately, that is kind of a product. It's a product of our media landscape in one sense, but I also do think that it has to do with the kind of cultural value of being an intellectual, and they go hand in hand.
I've been doing a little bit side reading on consumerism, which Donnie talked a little bit here, but there's this really interesting term called the empire of things, which is often used to relate modern consumerist culture. It's very like base level. And I do actually think, as you were talking about Sun Tzu, for example, or Machiavelli, that there is a really big component of philosophy. The most intense one is Stoicism, for sure, currently. But this really intense drive for like collecting, like basically a kind of intellectual self-help movement, where it's like, one of the things that I need to consume, one of the things that I need to have, one of the things that I need to get is being like smart, right? And being stable, or even being wise in that kind of like contorted view. And not to say that there's nothing to get out of Machiavelli or Sun Tzu or Stoics. Like, I actually really enjoy a lot of Stoic writing. But like you're saying, this sort of, often through media, this transition of that kind of, especially that kind of philosophy, into kind of pseudo self-help intellectualism, I also think really misses the point. And I think that, you know, I often end up going back to, you know, the classic Socrates, Plato, and thinking how, especially in early Platonic dialogues, early and middle, that Socrates is clearly very intellectual, is clearly very smart, but is also someone who's very moderate and very, what's the word I'm looking for? Humble, but he's uncommitted to any particular perspective, right? In the vast majority of cases. And it's very much a person who, like, doesn't know, right? He's out there, he's doing the philosophical search, he's trying to figure things out, he's chatting with people, he's annoying people. But the point is trying to, like, you know, like we said, like, actually have some wisdom, have some humility, figure out stuff that's going on. And that really comes through, I think, in those dialogues of him being someone who's genuinely just trying to figure this whole thing out as best that he, like, can. And not really, although he definitely does, like, best people, like, in arguments, he's not, very rarely posits his own position.
Yeah. I mean, he does, he doesn't have very many what we would call positive statements. He doesn't actually put forward very many substantive statements. There's a couple, but the point is, and what he's most known for, is being a kind of negative dialectician, taking things and doubting, questioning, analyzing, taking apart all kinds of things. I think another thing to the humility of Socrates in that way is that Socrates he says he goes to the lawyers and the courts and whatnot in the Apology, but everywhere that we see him in the dialogues is usually either in the agora, in the marketplace, where he's talking to craftsmen or just people who will give him their attention, or he's hanging out with his friends at other people's houses, you know, in the Republic. He's in, quote unquote, invited to another person's house. I think it was Cephalus' house and his son. And then we go to, in the Gorgias, we go to, I forget whose house it is. It's not Paulus's house. In any case, he's visiting all kinds of people. These are not academic excursions. These are not speeches he's making.
No, they're not. They're not.
The symposium. He makes a speech there.
and his trial, I guess, kind of. But again, yeah, it's that point of not, like, and I think that, you know what, the setting is very important, because if we're, you know, if we're kind of having a loose conversation about philosophy, obviously we're ending up on Socrates and Plato and stuff like that. But the fact that he's very much, the interesting thing about the dialogues, which I think you can kind of read into with what we're talking about in terms of having some sort of level of practical life and getting out there, is he's out there first. He's out there hanging out with people. He's going to festivals. He's going on little journeys, hanging out in the Agora. He's doing things. And then the sort of philosophical interests or happenings go on. And it's also really important a point to make, not to like gatekeep philosophy being for older people, because I don't think that's the case at all, but is that like during almost all the dialogues for Socrates are set in very much in his later life. And it's revealed, you know, early on that when he was a warrior, he was a soldier when he was a young man, but he was also, was he a sculptor? He did something like, or stonemason?
He had
some other vocation.
Yeah. So he was I think his family was a family of sculptors. Yes. So he was himself a techne, a craftsman.
Yeah. And so you have that point of like someone who's going out there, who's experiencing life, some of which is obviously very difficult, but like, you know, being involved in certain crafts and worlds, and only then sort of re-relating, shouldn't say only then, but also having those sorts of experiences, also having that kind of ability, while then eventually sliding into more philosophical discussions, right?
Sort
of second order reviews of things.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because there are a couple points in the Platonic corpus where we get glimpses of young Socrates. He goes to Diotima to get schooled on the art of love. He encounters Parmenides, where he puts forward his idea of the sun, and Parmenides is like, no, it's not like that.
That's a really interesting dialogue, because I like how we've transitioned to this sort of conversation, but like, again, coming back to what we're thinking about, it shows Socrates as a young man with a system. He's coming in there. He's got it figured out. This is how the world is. And then there's Parmenides, this much older, you know, respected philosopher, who basically shuts it down and is like, no. But then also at the end reveals his own grand system, which part of me finds kind of interesting in the more traditional Parmenides play, his monistic system. But ultimately, at least in the dialogue, it's kind of like insane. like it doesn't really, like, it's like so hard to get your head around, and the way it's like, And again, it's almost like we've got this like double motion of being like, system here, nix that. Okay, here's the more senior guy who nixed the other system, who, you know, this younger guy, he got it figured out. What's the older guy got to say? And it's also like what? You know, like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, well, you know, the funny thing is, because in the Parmenides, now we're talking about the Platonic dialogue, Parmenides, it's fine. He actually kind of rhetorically plays Socrates, because here's what happens. Socrates is trying to, he has this theory of the forms, and he says they're like the sun. And by the way, so the prerequisite is that they have to be indivisible. It has to be one. The forms are one. And Socrates says the forms are like the sun casting its light on the earth. The light covers multiple parts, but the sun remains one. And then Parmenides says, so it's like a sail? And then Socrates says, I guess so. And then Parmenides says, well, you can chop a sail up, so it must, your metaphor must not work. And then Socrates is like, oh, geez, you're right, Parmenides. I guess my metaphor doesn't work. But it's a false equivalent between the sun being divisible and the sail being divisible. And then you have the sort of metadramatic question of, okay, well, like, Plato knows he's doing this. What is Plato doing here, making an old schooler like Parmenides trip up a youngster like Socrates? And not only that, in the Republic, when we reach the height of Platonic philosophy with, you know, emerging from the cave to the sun, that system that was critiqued becomes the pinnacle of Plato's philosophy. So there is this, if we're talking about the way that people approach their own thinking and the way that that thinking survives criticism, or the way that it becomes received through, you know, a philosophical authority like Parmenides, the philosophical authority of the time. It's a really interesting way that that pans out dramatically, but it's also significant that Plato, as the writer here, he wrote that in. He didn't just, if we're noticing it, Plato is noticing it. So it's interesting to ask ourselves, what is Plato trying to communicate by making this reading possible? Has he kind of encoded and anticipated all kinds of different philosophical transmissions?
You know, I think this is a bit of an orthodox reading of it, but I think not specifically just of the dialogue, but of Plato himself, which also relates back to what we've been talking about here, where, you know, for our listeners, The Republic, which many might be familiar with, is generally considered to be a middle dialogue, mid-range in his corpus. And the Parmenides is generally considered to be like quite a bit later. And that potentially there's an aspect going on where it's almost like Plato, you know, the Republic shows where he was like most confident and committed to that. And the Parmenides shows later on him becoming more reflective and reinterrogating his own thinking in perhaps a position of being like, basically like leaving up to the reader, like, maybe I didn't have this right. Like, maybe this doesn't work like I thought it did. But also too, like, look over here, like this guy, Parmenides' character, like the people who are like doubting me, they might be right. Perhaps it's a little bit of like a jab as well. Like they might be correct. There might be issues, but like their offerings are not any better. You know, their complete systems are also very like wonky and disjointed and odd in their own way.
Yeah. And to take this back to the significance of questions here, again, we shouldn't think that, okay, well, there's this rift that's opened in, you know, Platonic philosophy now. We need to find the answers. I think that the point is that Plato is writing these questions in there. He does want us to move between different ways of approaching it. I'm remembering there is this anecdote that I forget whose translation of the Meno it is, but it's used as an epigram to the Meno, and it's a dream that Plato apparently had. Apparently Plato had a dream where he was a goose in a tree and people were trying to catch him, and then he flew into another tree to escape them. So the hunters run over to him to try and catch him, and then just flies back to the first tree, and he just keeps bouncing back and forth between the two trees, always evading being captured. And he asks Kebes, who stars in the Phaedo, Kebes gives him an interpretation. I don't know if he asks for it. And Kebes says, Plato, this dream is a sign that no one will ever tack you down. Your meaning will always evade people. I take this to mean that, and I'm sure Plato smiled at that because he kind of got recognition for what he was trying to do in his works, that he's trying to keep these questions open. He probably has some substantive things to argue for. Maybe in the Republic he felt like he had some commitments that he needed to communicate. But if this anecdote reflects if this dream reflects his project, Plato is trying to keep questions open. I think he is acknowledging kind of what we were discussing earlier on, that the significance of the questions is really, or the questions are really significant, and they're significant to keep alive. When you answer those questions, you foreclose on something really important.
Talking about, you know, Plato not being tacked down and that really interesting little dream anecdote, it made me think how on the one place where it seems like he was the most tacked down, the Republic, at least tacking himself down to a system, was also the spot in which he was one of them, perhaps not the most, being the most overtly politically constructive. And I think that there's something there with philosophy where, you know, once we start entering, okay, well, I'm going to take my system, I'm going to take what I've got here, theory of the forms and all this kind of stuff in Plato's case, and we're going to like transition this into like a political philosophy. Then it's got to harden, then it's got to calcify. It can no longer, at least it's difficult to see how it can continue to be a living question at that point. And obviously, you know, ultimately Plato was very dissatisfied with his like political movement, his political move within his own life and trying to like espouse that. Because on the one hand, we want philosophy to be very like practical, like we've been talking about. But on the other hand, there's a point at which like when it becomes something that we're trying to institute in like a political shift or personal change or whatever, but particularly political, I'll say, there's a component in which it does seem to sort of harden. And it, and in that sense becomes those questions don't become living questions. They become much more fragile posits about the way things are or should be, which is, you know, always obviously more fragile. They lose that kind of flexibility, lose that life, that vigor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. They become the problematic philosophy student who has decided on a system writ large. This panned out into a really interesting conversation. It was interesting to get into the nitty-gritty of some of the dramatic elements of the Platonic dialogue too, because I think that that does reflect a way of showing how one can read this stuff. It doesn't just have to be systematically. This stuff can have Plato especially, but all kinds of philosophy can be read in different ways, and you can derive all kinds of interesting significance from it. You've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I am Brandon, and I've been joined by Hale.
Email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Thank you.
You are listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby.